From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Happy Monday to you, and hopefully you'll have a short week as Thanksgiving is right around the corner. Coming up, we speak with the mayor of Malibu to find out how the city is doing now that residents are being allowed to return to their homes. Unfortunately, though, some people will not have a home to return to. Hundreds of houses in Malibu have burned down. Also, we're going to speak to Bill Addison. He's one of the two new food critics at the LA Times.
I find the chefs here have a really nimble approach to both tradition and innovation.
That's coming up. First, President Trump was in California this weekend. He toured areas affected by the deadly Camp Fire up north and the Woolsey Fire in Malibu. And he also met with families affected by the shooting in Thousand Oaks. For more on that visit, we go to Ben Adler, Capitol Bureau Chief for Capitol Public Radio. Welcome back, Ben.
And A, in the spirit of everyone over the weekend, I am not going to insult you at all during this segment.
Oh, okay. Ben, how was the presidential visit received?
Everyone was on their best behavior. And this was, of course, notable because you have seen a lot of criticisms flying back and forth the 3,000 miles between California and Washington, particularly between Trump and Newsom, but to a lesser extent, Governor Brown really criticizing the president on his positions and beliefs on climate change, and Trump pushing back at California in particular on the state's immigration policies and the sanctuary state bill. And, of course, leading up to this trip, the president had raised concerns about California's forest management practices, saying that they were so bad and so much to blame that if they're not fixed, he was going to stop signing presidential aid declarations. And so when you look at it compared to that, everyone really was cordial and kind and shook hands and praised each other throughout the weekend. There was even a hug.
Well, that's good. That's good news, at least. Now, on Saturday, the president was in Chico. He had been asked if seeing the devastation changed his opinion about climate change. And then he said this.
No, I have a strong opinion. I want great climate. We're going to have that. And we're going to have forests that are very safe because we can't go through this every year. We go through this and we're going to have safe forests. And that's happening as we speak.
So still been kind of ducking the climate change question there. What else did we see and hear from President Trump this weekend?
Well, beyond the praise, for Brown and for Newsom, he did talk about money in the farm bill, $500 million, $500 million. And we don't have any details about that. I reached out to the White House about that and have yet to hear back. But we do know that Congress is supposedly going to take up the farm bill in its lame duck session in the coming weeks. And there may be some money for forest management and maintenance, but that is nationwide, $500 million nationwide. Not the most money in the world, but it is something. And there were promises from the president that he will be there for California, that he will continue to make sure that the money is flowing from the federal government. And that's a big deal as well.
Yeah. And one of the things that did come up on the president's trip was his recent tweet in which he blamed California's deadly fires on forest mismanagement, then threatened to withhold, as you mentioned, the federal funding. Governor Jerry Brown spoke to CBS's Face the Nation and said that Trump had backed off on the threat.
Yes. So that's a big, big win. The president not only has signed a presidential declaration giving California substantial funding, but he said and pledged very specifically to continue to help us, that he's got our back.
Yeah, Ben, in true Jerry Brown fashion, he seems to have looked past the tweets to secure funding. Is this just the last few remnants of classic Jerry Brown?
It is certainly not the first time he has done that with President Trump. And what comes to mind is when the president wanted to send the National Guard to the border, call up the National Guard in border states. And the three Republican governor states of Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona said, yeah, sure, right away. Brown took about a week. There were calls for him to reject the effort. I think the governor and some folks felt that might have been falling right into the president's trap. Instead, he said yes, but ensured there were clear rules of engagement so that there would be no immigration enforcement from those troops and that they would continue to work on, gun trafficking, human trafficking, drug smuggling, the issues that California needs more money to do anyway. So this could be a similar situation where he just kind of stayed below the radar and did not engage with the president on that. And one thing we'll need to watch moving forward is how Gavin Newsom acts, because he has engaged President Trump much more vociferously on Twitter and elsewhere. And whether that will continue or whether he will temper the tone a little bit as governor, we'll see in early January.
Well, let's get into that hug felt around the state with Gavin Newsom. Here's sound of that.
This is a very big problem, and we have to solve this problem. And I know that we're going to work together. I have no doubt. Come here. I have no doubt. Right? We're going to get it done.
Come here. He brought him in. Ben, did the tone surprise you?
Well, it's a little reminiscent of Chris Christie when he was governor of New Jersey, hugging it out with President Obama just before the 2012 presidential election, after Superstorm Sandy devastated New Jersey. So, look, I mean, in times of crisis, the nation's leaders are supposed to rise to the occasion and put politics aside. And at least on Saturday, all three of those leaders did that. We will see to what extent that continues in the coming days and weeks and months and years.
Yeah, a little slice of entourage there at in California. Ben Adler is Capital Bureau Chief for Capital Public Radio. Ben, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, keeping with the fires, let's focus on Northern California, where the massive campfire has scorched over 150,000 acres. It's just under 70% contained. And then there are more devastating numbers on this. Over 15,000 structures have been destroyed. At least 77 people have died. Nearly 1,000 are missing as of this morning. Now, as the community struggles to wrap its head around the tragedy, let's check in with Mark Alpert. He's a reporter for North State Public Radio. Mark, welcome.
Good morning. Good morning to you.
Now, you've been reporting in Paradise. You've also spent time at evacuation centers. What kind of emotions are evacuees experiencing right now that they've shared with you?
Well, the adrenaline that carried people off the hillside and into the shelters is starting to wear off, and people are starting, while they're still incredibly grateful for all the help that they're receiving, there's really an outpouring of community spirit. The generosity around Northern California, with people unsolicited pouring in with donations, with food. I ran into a group from a barbecue restaurant in Sonora that packed up and drove out here. There are people coming from Reno, people coming from Oregon to help sort food donations for animals. People are really being supported. That said, they've been out of their homes for over a week. People are fraying at the nerves. It's hard enough to keep families together, and these are really trying circumstances.
And there's that norovirus outbreak too. I mean, these people must be just at their wits' end.
Yeah, that's correct. There was a norovirus outbreak at one of the shelters. It spread to two others. They had 150 cases, and misery upon misery. You know, if you're in, in a lot of these shelters, they're in the county fairgrounds, and so there are not, 75 restrooms. And if you could imagine 50 people suffering from that, having to share a small number of restrooms, it's very, very terrible situation.
Mark, has there been any talk about what's next for these people?
Well, I've been hearing from city and county officials that FEMA and Cal OES have been assembling and marshaling all sorts of resources by the Chico Airport. I tried to get out there Saturday night, and I was turned away at the gate, but there are convoys of semis going up there. And it's not really clear what exactly is going to happen. The County Housing Authority director told me yesterday that FEMA was looking at building 2,000 units of housing somewhere, and they were looking for sites and hoping to build these sites in 200-unit villages. It's unclear if this would be trailers, if it would be prefabricated homes. There are people, volunteers, who were building simple shelters, kind of like backyard tool sheds for the homeless. They're offering, of course, to help with constructing those types of shelters for evacuees, as well as folks converting shipping containers.
Wow.
There are also city officials say that everything is on the table. They were looking at upzoning. They were talking about stopping some major developments that are already in progress. And changing them up to allow additional structures, additional housing. But there's the financial aspect of this that, the market is not going to provide for. Unlike a lot of the rest of California, Paradise was certainly one of the more affordable places. People there kind of stretched thin, even in the best of times. A lot of people on fixed incomes, a lot of simple housing structures, and complete and utter devastation.
All right, that's Mark Alpert from North State Public Radio. Mark, thank you very much.
It's an honor and a pleasure, as always. Thank you.
All right, moving on. California is one of the richest states in the nation, but in the shadow of all that wealth, hundreds of thousands of Californians live in poverty, and many of them are minors. Today, a state task force is releasing a new report that details the specific problems of child poverty. The goal is to create solutions that would help at least 450,000 kids. Joining us now in studio is Conway Collis, president and CEO of GRACE, a Pasadena-based nonprofit that helps children in poverty. He's also co-chair of the state task force that released today's report, Lift Children and Families Out of Poverty. Welcome.
Thank you for having me here.
Now, first, give us a portrait of what childhood poverty looks like in California. What have you, Conway, seen up close?
When we've dealt with, for example, children who have been sexually trafficked, so many of those children come out of the foster care system. They virtually all come out of abject poverty. They end up on the streets. They end up being trafficked. And I know some of those children, and I've heard their stories, and I've heard what they've gone through. Their resilience is incredible. But it, in a sense, we have to realize that those are our children. Those are California's children. And we have the power to address it.
What about the view from higher up? What are the statistics of child poverty in the state?
Well, California has the highest number and the highest percentage of children and families in poverty of any state in the country. You know, we used to think about that it was perhaps some southern state, but it's right here in the Golden State. Almost 2 million children living below the federal poverty line, 450,000 of them,
right,
almost
yeah.
half a million living in deep child poverty, which means that they're living in a family of four under $12,500 a year. Think about that as if 450,000 children were a city, because if they were a city, that would be the eighth largest city in California.
It's the size of Long Beach, 450,000, yeah.
What California has lacked is a roadmap to eliminate deep child poverty.
Well, what's at stake for kids in California if the state doesn't come together and addresses this right away?
The number is going to continue to increase, but we have to realize is for every time we see a child or family on the street, every time we see or hear about a child who's been sexually trafficked, we have to realize that we have a responsibility both to that child and to the other 450,000 children in the state who are in deep child poverty, and it's time to say enough. You can't have almost half a million children living in deep poverty.
Conway Collis is president and CEO of GRACE, a Pasadena-based nonprofit that helps children in poverty. He's also co-chair of a state task force that released today's report, Lift Children and Families Out of Poverty. Conway, in this new report, the task force outlines some potential solutions. One of them includes more cash assistance and subsidies for impoverished children and their families. What would that sort of help look like for the family receiving it?
When people have financial resources or receive financial resources, they know what to do with them. They want to spend them on their children, and they want their children to have a reasonable shot. And so this money tends to be spent in the right way. That's what the studies show very clearly. They're not going to be moved out of poverty totally, but at least they're going to be at a subsistence level so that the child is not going hungry, the child's not living in a rat-infested apartment. So at least they're living in a situation where the child is able to learn. For every dollar that people receive in terms of additional income, mm-hmm. the child in that family actually benefits 10 times over in terms of increased earnings when they're an adult.
Now, let's look at one more idea covered in this report, and that includes help for families struggling to keep a roof over their heads. Homelessness is a big problem throughout the state, but what's the proposal to specifically assist children?
So the way it would work is that similar to the earned income tax credit in California, families would be encouraged mm-hmm. to submit a tax return even if they had no income.
Okay.
And the franchise tax board, the state tax board, would simply look at that level of income to see what more is necessary in the particular area that someone is living and build into it enough so that the family is able to keep or obtain an apartment.
So it sounds
in
like
that
it
area.
Depends on where the family is living.
Exactly.
One other thing, Conway, because I can imagine already people saying, well, how do we make sure that this money gets to the kids to help these kids not live in deep poverty? So how do we ensure that? How do we make sure that happens?
you know, let's realize that families in deep poverty, or these are generally hardworking people. These are people that are often working two and three jobs. It's just not enough to get them above the poverty line or even out of deep child poverty. They're just not making enough. And so all of the information shows that when people are given money to help their children, they know how to spend it and they spend it on their children. The cost of having a child in terms of the food, diapers for infants, all of those costs far exceed what someone is going to get in terms of any kind of a state subsidy. So it's not going to be enough overall to allow spending on luxuries. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be enough to support what the child needs.
So this is a multi-pronged approach. We can't cover all the proposals in today's discussion with you, Conway, but what's the next step? I mean, who has to take the lead in approving these ideas and by when?
The next step is for the legislature to introduce a package of bill implementing the task force recommendations. And what's really crucial is that that moves forward quickly with the support of the Newsom administration and gets enacted into law, because it's not until it is enacted into law that we're actually going to see the benefits and we're not actually going to see deep child poverty eliminated in California over the next 4 years.
Conway Collis is president and CEO of GRACE, a Pasadena-based nonprofit designed to help children in poverty. He's also co-chair of the state task force Lift Children and Families Out of Poverty. Conway, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, coming up in just a bit, we're going to go live to Malibu, hear from the mayor on some of the immediate issues they're dealing with as people are heading back to their neighborhoods. Now, that's a short term. That's what's next. But what about next week, next month, next year, and even beyond? And what do you do if there's no neighborhood to come back to? Coming up, we'll hear from someone who faced that exact scenario 25 years ago. That's ahead when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now at Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. As of this morning, the Woolsey fire is 94% contained. Full containment is expected Thursday. Almost 97,000 acres have burned and 1,500 structures have been destroyed. One of the hardest hit areas was the seaside community of Malibu. Last week, mandatory evacuations were ordered for the entire city and the Santa Monica Mountains. But by this afternoon, most residents will be allowed back to assess the damage. For more on how that community is doing, we turn to its mayor, Rick Mullen, who's also a fire captain of Station 72 in the Malibu Hills. Rick, thank you for taking some time for us.
My pleasure, and I appreciate you helping me and the city to get the word out.
No problem, Rick. Now, evacuations were lifted for the Point Doom area yesterday. That's expected to happen today. Is that the plan?
Yeah, as of 9 o'clock this morning, virtually all of Malibu will be open. PCH had a hard closure up to about Paradise Cove early yesterday, and they moved it to Guernsey, which includes Zuma Beach. So Point Doom was open yesterday, and as of this morning, they've extended all the way to County Line from the Santa Monica direction. You can't come in from the Oxnard direction. So if you're coming from Santa Monica, you can get all the way into the city of Malibu. So for some of the communities like up in Corral Canyon or Latigo or whatever, which is actually unincorporated Los Angeles County, a lot of those are still closed because that's where some of the more challenging infrastructure replacements of telephone poles and electricity, et cetera, are still going on. But in terms of the actual city of Malibu, it's virtually the entire city is open as of now.
Now, on the first blush, that sounds like great news, right? Evacuations lifted. Everyone can go back. But what will the people find when they actually go back?
Well, in the eastern part, the relatively unaffected parts, they have all their services. They have electrical, they have water, et cetera. And even some of the stores are open. I went down to Ralph's yesterday, and it's open for business.
Okay.
But as you get further west toward Point Doom and stuff, there are still a lot of areas that do not have electricity. We made the decision to let everyone in. We felt that it was more important for people to get back into their neighborhoods and start picking up the pieces and assessing whether your house survived or didn't survive. It's important for everybody to get back in there, even though they didn't have electrical power. Just I felt that in terms of security also, if you repopulate the neighborhood with the people who actually live there, they'll be able to tell who doesn't belong there. So in terms of looters, it does assist in security. There are challenges for people that go back to a house that doesn't have electricity. But I think given the choice, most of the people that I spoke to want to get back. We do have water pretty much in most of the city. I know there are some places where it's a little intermittent. Now, the one problem is that that's going to happen today is Southern California Edison said they were going to turn the power off to all of Malibu for a portion of the day today while they're working on their re-energization of the whole thing. You'll have to ask them what the specifics are of that. So that's an unfortunate thing that's happening today. But in terms of all the neighborhoods that have been affected, I know everybody wanted to get back in. I think that's a good idea.
We're talking to Malibu Mayor Rick Mullen. Rick, you're also a firefighter. Right now you're at your station in the hills outside of the city proper. What's it like up there?
Well, where my station is, which is it's up on Decker Canyon Road, and it's up in, I would say, is the most sparsely populated district of all of the fire stations, the 12 fire stations that cover Malibu and Westlake, Calabasas, Agora, et cetera, and unincorporated areas. The most sparsely populated, but is the most severely impacted because it's a heavy brush area, and I normally have about 240 residents here, and 140 of those 240 homes have been destroyed. I went out and wrote down all the addresses of the ones that have been destroyed. So percentage-wise, it's much more severely impacted than the city of Malibu, which only lost about 300 homes, and that's got 13,000 people in it. But it's also much more sparsely populated. So numerically, it's about 140 homes that are lost in this district. But all these hills that previously had heavy brush, some of which hasn't burned for 50 years, has been completely vaporized, and it looks like post-nuclear war up here.
Rick, there's a slight chance of rain in the forecast for Wednesday, and because of that, debris flows are now a big concern for everyone in the burn areas. How's the city preparing for that? Because even if it doesn't rain this week, it will rain at some point.
Yeah, it's a big concern. It's sort of the wrong thing at the wrong time, but it could be the right thing at the wrong time if it's light enough. If it's light enough and it's not severe, then maybe it can assist in getting all those little plants to start with their shoots coming up through the ground and grabbing onto the soil and holding on to it. If it's not supposed to be that much rain, from what I understand, but it's supposed to come in a fairly concentrated period. So as far as mud and debris flow, it's a major concern. The County of Los Angeles Department of Public Works that's very high on their priority list, as well as the fire department. The fire department is proactive in bringing sand, extra sand, like three times as much as they normally do out to all the stations, and three times as many sandbags that are already in place. So, but the scale of what we're talking about here is pretty much beyond what we can even really imagine. So if it's bad, it could be severe. And for a lot of the neighborhoods that are at the mouths of some of these canyons, they may well be looking at mandatory evacuations if conditions look like they're going to get worse. And I know no one's going to be happy about that because it took them a while to get back in. But you know, when you're talking about giant areas where you really could literally have a wall of mud just coming down and engulfing something, this is something that people have to take very seriously. So I'm hoping Mother Nature will be kind to us and not give it to us too severely.
Hey,
but
Rick,
it is a danger and it's a concern, and everyone's on top of their list.
I can't help but notice you've coughed a few times during our chat. How's the air quality up there?
So the air quality is better than it's been. A lot of people are wearing little masks, et cetera. Now I'm coughing because I was involved in, you know, pretty severe conditions in the first couple of days of the fire. That's kind of a lingering cough I've got. But, you know, I'm no longer coughing up black stuff. I'm actually much better than I was. But the air quality has improved significantly, but it's not back to what it was. Generally speaking, in Malibu, you know, we get a little bit of an ocean breeze, which brings in clean air from off the ocean. So down in the city, it's better than it was. But as people walk along, you know, the debris areas and kick up dust, the quality of the air in general is not what it used to be. Much better than it's been in the last week. So people should, if they have a mask, wear it as you're sniffing around your house and trying to find all your belongings. Don't make any assumptions that you can't get affected by it. You can. It looks better than it did during the fire, but there's still a lot of air quality issues. But comparatively speaking, what it's been over the last week, it's much better.
That's Malibu Mayor and Fire Captain Rick Mullen. Rick, take care. Thank you very much.
Hey, I appreciate the opportunity to talk. Take care.
The Woolsey Fire is mostly contained at this point, but it's caused a lot of destruction in the 11 days it's been burning. Now, as we mentioned earlier, 1,500 structures have been destroyed, including hundreds of homes in Malibu. As evacuation orders are lifted, many are returning to find that there is little left. So what do you do after a disaster if you've lost your home? Karen York wrote about this in the Malibu Times. She lost her home to a fire in 1993. Karen, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, after you lost your home all those years ago, you formed a support group for others going through the same thing. So thinking back on what you experienced, what are some of the earliest feelings that people who just lost their homes might be having right now?
Well, you're overwhelmed. People have a life, and they can't live that life anymore. They have to deal with other things that are more essential, like where to live. How do you deal with your children? You know, what do I need to buy first? Eventually, within a few days, maybe within a few hours, you begin to grieve for your lost treasures. Then you feel stranded and homeless and a feeling of disbelief, maybe even denial.
It's a strange feeling, Karen. I lost my home, not in a wildfire, but in a fire, 2006. And it's a weird feeling because you're in the moment, but you're also thinking ahead 6 months, a year from now. Where am I going to be? But what do I have to do right now to just get situated? I mean, how do you get your head around this?
Well, it's not easy, but one has to put one foot in front of the other, you know, for their family's sake, for their own mental health's sake. And people do find that they want to start, but they don't know where to start or how to start. And that's one of the reasons we put together this list of what to do, first steps when your house burns down.
So, Karen, then what's the first thing that people should do there on the scene?
When they return to their homes, the first thing they have to do is stop and look and take it in. Don't start doing anything at first. In fact, until you start taking it in, it's not real. And I think in order to act, it has to be real. The second thing is if you feel that you have to do something to begin to sift the ashes, don't do it unless you have proper gear. You should have a professional mask. You should be wearing gloves. You should have a shovel. Building materials now can be extremely toxic, and the air and the dust that's going to be in the air around your properties is very toxic. So I guess that goes back to the first thing. Take care of yourself. The last thing that you need is to get sick or have an accident on top of everything else.
Talking to Karen York, she wrote about what you do right after a disaster if you lost your home in the Malibu Times. Karen, shelter, because that's your next step, right? I mean, immediate step. Where do you sleep that night? Where do you sleep in the next few nights as you're trying to figure out what to do? What do you recommend for those looking for a place to stay?
I would say the first order of business is start looking for permanent housing, because you really need to have a space. You and your family need the space. And I'm sure you're not being great guests. The people who are victims of fire are not great house guests. Yeah. They're on the phone all the time. They're listening to the news all the time. Your friends will be very patient and loving and supportive. But at the same time, you don't want to be imposing either. And that's adding extra stress to you. So find a place to live. It doesn't have to be fancy as long as it meets your basic needs. The problem in Malibu, of course, is that we have a very low inventory of rental properties here. And the ones that we have are very expensive. So consider taking a space in our adjoining communities if you can. That would be my recommendation.
Now, when it comes to insurance, that is something I'm sure hopefully people have insurance to be able to deal with. But what should people do to avoid holdups?
I think that your best advisor is your insurance broker. If you find that your insurance people are not as cooperative, or you don't have the insurance you thought you had, or you have a particularly complicated claim, we use an independent adjuster. Now, they charge for their services, but we found that that was a very useful option.
Oh, why? In what way?
Well, they represent you, not the insurance company. They're on your side. These are licensed, trained people. You should make sure you get the right ones. There's several of them in the Los Angeles area, statewide Los Angeles area. But we found that having our own consultant that helped us interface with the insurance company was very useful.
What about just everything that happens throughout the day when it comes to dealing with insurance companies or when it comes to just dealing with everything? Should we be writing this stuff down just to either have a record of it or make sure we don't forget things?
I would say the first thing you want to buy is a notebook, like a binder, and lots of blank pages and dividers for the various aspects of your recovery, and write everything down, and write everyone you talk to, everyone that you who has given you advice officially, their name, their organization, their phone numbers, what they said, when they said it, what promises were made, what your expectations are, how are you going to follow up, and carry that with you or put it in your computer.
Can I email it? Yeah, I can email it to myself. Yeah.
Well, you can write it down either in your computer or on paper.
Yeah.
You know, and you can organize your. I would say just organize your files right now. You know, in your computer. And speaking of which, back up your computer.
Yeah.
Hopefully to the cloud, if you even back it up to a whatever device you back up to, but make sure you have that. And also, I would recommend that you go out to Staples and purchase a backup battery for your phone and for your computer. Because you'll be using it a lot, and you'll be using it in places where there's not necessarily a place to hook up electrically. So
now, Karen, that's all stuff in the material world. What
mm-hmm.
about taking care of me, you inside?
Well, of course, please take care of yourselves physically. Eat properly. Try not to do too much binging on whatever your comfort place is. Watch your drinking, your eating, overeating, candy, whatnot. You want to stay healthy. It's very important. Emotionally, I think that surrounding yourself with, family and friends is really important. But probably the most important thing for us was surrounding yourself with other people who were going through what you were going through. Nobody can really understand. They say things that they mean to be kind, like, this is what not to say to a burn victim, right?
Yeah.
What not to say? Don't tell them about the beautiful house they're going to have someday.
Yeah.
And how lucky they are to have the opportunity to replace all their stuff, and they're going to have new. I mean, yeah, that's true, but that's not what they want to hear right now.
That is tough to hear. I heard that a lot
yeah.
When I was trying to figure things out. Now, Karen, what would you say is the biggest thing that people often forget?
The biggest thing that people often forget is to take care of themselves. I was thinking today, if you have a dentist appointment, go. If you have a beauty shop appointment, go. Take a walk on the beach. Go to a movie. Take your kids on a picnic. You know, everything is in your mind. All you have is to-do lists, endless to-do lists, all that anxiety, and you end up getting sick. The body has a way of saying stop that way if it has to. So let's, keep healthy and keep strong and find yourself the support groups that you need to be in.
That's Karen York. She's publisher of the Malibu Times. She wrote a list of things to do if you lose your home in a fire. You can find a link to that article on our website. That's take2.org. Karen, thank you very much for making the time.
Oh, thank you.
We've seen through social media how the extent of fire damage has reached the Hollywood community. Actors' homes destroyed, movie sets, iconic ones, long-standing movie sets just wiped out. Now, with Oscar season revving up, the entertainment biz is rethinking how to celebrate and have fun while still having their neighbors' needs on their minds. Coming up, find out what you won't see on all the Hollywood red carpets in the coming months. That's ahead when Take Two continues. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Last night, L.A.'s Dolby Theater hosted the Governor's Awards, a popular campaign tour stop for Oscar contenders. But in the shadow of the destructive Woolsey fire, there's been some scaling back of future red carpet events. Let's go on the lot.
God, if I would
stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan is here to break it all down. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, A.
All right, you were there at the Governor's Award last night, which, as we mentioned, a popular spot for those on the Oscar campaign trail. Why is that?
Yeah, it's funny. When the Academy created this event 10 years ago, many people were skeptical. They removed the awarding of these particular Oscars from the main telecast, and they put them in November. It's become a sort of must event, the must attend event of award season. Last night, there were a lot of actors there from contending movies. Lady Gaga from A Star is Born, Lupita Nyong'o from Black Panther, Lin-Manuel Miranda from Mary Poppins, Emma Stone from The Favourite, also filmmakers, Barry Jenkins from If Beale Street Could Talk, Alfonso Cuarón with Roma. So a big crowd of people, all with movies just about in arriving in theaters, wanting to sort of mix and mingle with Academy members, journalists, and with their peers.
So make no mistake, campaigning has begun.
For sure, yeah. Yes. Campaigning, I think, begins the day after the Oscars, to be honest. But yes, yeah. this was like awards-a-palooza weekend.
So who are some of the major honorees?
Well, it was last night was actually really quite lovely. Composer Lalo Schifrin was honored, publicist Marvin Levy, producing duo Kathleen Kennedy and Frank Marshall. I think perhaps the most emotional moment of the ceremony was when Cicely Tyson received her honorary Oscar. Tyson had been nominated for her performance in Sounder in 1972, but there was, I think, a sense among many in the room that her career, coming as it had in the heart of the civil rights movement, had been so groundbreaking and so had opened doors for many people. One of the people who introduced her was Tyler Perry, who made the point that, quote, Black people couldn't come through the front door when she started in the business. Tyson really served as sort of a possibility model for many people, not only women of color, but other people who I think felt a little excluded by the entertainment industry.
Now, you mentioned Lady Gaga earlier. I know that she was one of the people that was affected by all the fires. What was the atmosphere like in that regard? Because I'm sure a lot of attendees had fire stories or had something to say about it.
They did. Academy President John Bailey opened the evening with remarks about the fires and many people still missing, homes affected. He also noted that the Academy had been affected in its own way by the burning of the Paramount Ranch, which we've talked about on this show. That was a site where the Academy held some screenings of silent films. One of the people I spoke to was Sam Elliott, who was there for A Star is Born. He had just ridden out the wildfire in Malibu with his wife, Catherine Ross, and they had stayed when their neighborhood was evacuated and poured water, were able to save their house. But he described a sort of surreal experience of being in his tuxedo, heading through police barricades, picking up a can of propane to come to this black tie event at the Dolby Ballroom.
Now, that brings us to how the Academy is scaling back the red carpet due to fire. So what's that going to look like?
Well, that was for this particular event. I don't know that will be in future events. But yes, there was the usual photography, but not on-camera interviews. This had also happened at the AFI Film Festival last week. Some of the red carpet events were sort of removed. The movie still premiered, but they didn't do the usual sort of step and repeat answering journalist questions.
Because one of the things I'm hearing, Rebecca, is that those swag bags that everyone gets for all these events, that find a firefighter, give the swag bag to them.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't heard that. Yeah, I mean, I do think there catastrophes like this always have a way of putting kind of the silliness of something like award season in perspective for a lot of people in a way that is important. By the same token, as a journalist, I'm always bummed when they are not, you know, down to talk. It was a relief to get to talk to some, just walk up to some people at their tables last night and hear how they were doing in the midst of the fires.
Now, staying with the Academy, in your last piece for Vanity Fair, you wrote about the proposed Oscar for Achievement in Popular Film, which board members floated as an idea and inspired a lot of debate. Why was there so much backlash to this?
Well, if you recall, when this idea was first sort of made public in August, there was not a lot of specifics shared along with it, and so many Academy members weren't entirely sure what popular meant. Would it be defined by box office, by people voting, audience members voting? So there was that issue. And then there was sort of a core issue, which not only Academy members but people more broadly spoke to, which was that it perhaps a popular Oscar would tarnish the idea of sort of artistic excellence, which the Academy kind of considers a core principle.
There are awards. I know. I don't want to get on my
soapbox. Precious.
Well, you know.
I mean, what is the point of the show if not for you to get on your soapbox?
I know, right?
Yeah.
I know. But this category we're talking about has precedent, right?
Well, it does. One thing that I did not know until I started working on this story was that at the first Oscars in 1929, there were actually two movies that were sort of versions of Best Picture. There was Wings, which won, quote-unquote, Outstanding Picture. That was a big war epic from William Wellman. And then there was this movie Sunrise from F.W. Murnau, which is a romance, which won a category called Unique and Artistic Picture. that was the only year that the Academy had two different prizes, but it suggests that sort of from the very beginning, the Academy was grappling with this kind of existential question of when you're celebrating a popular art form, what matters more, the popularity or the art?
Yeah, I'll go down my soapbox for a second. This isn't sports. In sports, there's the team that scores the most points is the winner, the other is the loser. Just because you don't win an award doesn't mean you're a loser.
Okay.
So
you tell that to the losers.
I know, right? I know. I won't, though, because they won't understand. Now, okay, real quick. Achievement for popular film is not dead, right? So where does it stand right now?
Yeah, you know, the Academy did decide to table it for this year. They felt they didn't have enough time to roll it out. But many of the board members who I've spoken to have said it's not gone entirely. They're going to revisit it early in the new year.
Now, really quick, let's wrap things up with the box office. Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald made its big debut. It did not compare very well to other Harry Potter films.
Well, yeah, it opened at $62 million domestically. That's down from the first Fantastic Beasts film, which opened at $74 million. Did better internationally, $191 million, but still there may be little signs, at least here in the U.S., of some franchise fatigue.
Is J.K. Rowling's magic over in the U.S.?
I do think people are starting to feel like the magic is waning.
Wave the wand.
Wave that
wider,
wand.
Right?
Yeah.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Monday to talk about the business of Hollywood. Rebecca, thank you very much.
Thanks, A.
The passing of Jonathan Gold left a huge void in the hearts of L.A. food lovers. How could anyone else really possibly fill the shoes of the Pulitzer Prize award-winning writer? Well, the L.A. Times has finally made its choice. Actually, they made two choices. Coming up, we'll hear the on-the-down-low way they're going to try and cover the massive and diverse L.A. food scene. Find out how when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm E. Martinez. For more than 30 years, L.A. Times food critic Jonathan Gold helped Angelenos learn more about themselves through food. So when the 57-year-old Pulitzer Prize winner died in July, many wondered who could possibly fill those shoes. Well, late last week, we got an answer when the L.A. Times named its new critics. That's right, I said critics. There are two. Bill Addison, national critic for Eater.com, and Patricia Escarcega, former critic for the Phoenix New Times. Bill Addison is with me now. Bill, welcome.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Now, I should mention the Times has been beefing up its food staff. It's already hired New York Times Lucas Peterson and Peter Meehan, who edited the James Beard award-winning food magazine Lucky Peach. Now, there are two critics. What's important, Bill, about having two?
I think that the thinking was that it's Los Angeles. There is so much to cover in one city that it really is enough for two critics, at least. There could probably be even more critics covering the huge, vast cultural expanse that comprises Los Angeles.
You guys aren't going to get territorial or anything. Like, this is my part of town. Stay on your part of town.
That's the I think, the best part about it. We absolutely are not going in that we would both be covering high-end, low-end, everything in between. Both Patricia and I will be mixing it up constantly. And even though Los Angeles, of course, is where we'll be concentrating our efforts, we'll also be keeping an eye on the rest of California and sometimes beyond.
Now, you recently published a list of America's 38 essential restaurants for Eater. It includes four restaurants from Los Angeles. So here's the big L.A. food scene question, Bill. What makes this food scene unique in your view?
I was Eater's national critic for almost 5 years. So I have been saying for years that Los Angeles is absolutely the most exciting food city in America. Two things, I guess, that I have noticed in my frequent travels to Los Angeles. Number one is the dining public is incredibly engaged. I don't really think that a dining landscape, a city's food ecology, becomes excellent without diners of all kinds really willing to support restaurants of all kinds. Also, I find the chefs here have a really nimble approach to both tradition and innovation in any cuisine that they choose. And they run with it, but they do it with skill, an unusual skill. And so kind of all those factors
combine together to make this just like a powerhouse of a dining town.
We're talking to Bill Addison. He's one of the two new food critics for the LA Times. Now, one of the things that stood out to me, Bill, from the LA Times story about your hire is that you two, with Patricia, will review anonymously. So what was behind that decision?
It's a tricky thing because I do believe that it's wonderful to not be recognized by a chef, to come in and have as close to the same meal as everyone else in the restaurant. That said, I don't think that restaurant criticism is beholden to anonymity. So because neither Patricia and I are that recognizable in the Los Angeles restaurant scene, because we both have done a pretty good job of keeping our face off the internet, we're going to be anonymous for as long as we can be. And I think that I'll speak for myself. If it becomes some sort of farce where I feel like every time I walk into a restaurant, I'm recognized and the only people in the dark about that are the readers, then I will be happy to show my face in public and probably won't make too much of a big deal about it.
Now, Bill, for a lot of people, Jonathan Gold really served the most important role that a food critic can serve, and that's of discovery, writing about places you might have never, ever found out about. Now you go on Yelp, and there are really countless ways to discover new restaurants. So post Jonathan Gold, Bill, what's the role of a Los Angeles food critic, and more specifically, an LA Times food critic?
Well, I think, first of all, it's just to carry on the good work that Jonathan did, because here's the difference. With Yelp reviews, Jonathan and all good food critics offer context. They offer a narrative. We're not only telling you, go to Here's Looking at You and get the hamachi collar and the bone marrow, but also how this restaurant, how this chef plays into the landscape, what neighborhood is he in. That's always the real work of a restaurant review. And I think it's more important than ever because, as you said, there are so many ways to find out about restaurants. It's so noisy out there. You want a trusted voice to tell you what they think about what they're eating and why.
When it comes to covering the LA food scene, I think it would be pretty easy just to kind of stay on the high end, Bill. What will you and your team do when it comes to really going out there and really showcasing, as Jonathan Gold once put, the cultural mosaic of food in LA?
Well, that's exactly the perfect way to put it. I think that you can expect us to be painting in every color of that mosaic. So, I've written a lot about tasting menus in my life, but I've also written about, plenty of much humbler restaurants, serving cuisines from every corner of the globe. And because Los Angeles is this incredibly multicultural panorama, the food culture reflects the broader makeup of Los Angeles. And that's what we really want to capture in our food coverage.
Bill Addison was the national food critic for Eater.com. He's now one of the two new food critics for the Los Angeles Times. Bill, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, you can find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can find me Twitter and Instagram, same address, at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. Coming up next, it's Air Talk, John Raby in for Larry Mantle. We'll talk to you guys tomorrow.